From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1874 when the United States saw its first documented case of child abuse. The victim was a 9-year-old girl named Mary Ellen. Her foster mother had repeatedly beat, burned, and cut her and would lock her in a closet. A concerned neighbor sent for someone to check on the child, and that set in motion a legal process that would have a powerful impact on future cases. The Mary Ellen case would be covered by the New York Times, and it led to the creation of the New York Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children. Mary Ellen was removed from that household. Her stepmother was convicted of the abuse. In a new book called Abusive Policies, University of Rochester public policy and health professor Dr. Michal Raz writes that by the end of the 19th century, the approach to child welfare was rather nuanced. Physical abuse, of course, was not tolerated, but other issues related to child welfare were seen in different ways. If a child had dirty clothes or was not well fed, or one of the first questions was whether the child's parents might need more support. Raz writes, quote, most progressive era child advocates focused on keeping families intact and providing needed supports to parents, particularly mothers. In a report of an 1899 conference, the Committee on Neglected and Dependent Children highlighted the centrality of family preservation. When a family is broken, members of the community argued, it is no easy task to bring it together, whereas a few dollars of private charity and friendly encouragement could lift up the deserving poor. This is also evident from the 1909 White House Conference on the Care of Dependent Children, whose report famously argued that homes should not be broken up for reasons of poverty, end quote. So when did things change? Raz chronicles how the focus shifted, and for the past 50 years or so, the impulse is for the system to be punitive instead of supportive. Raz writes that the system is especially predatory toward black and brown families who are much more likely to have children taken away. The book is part history lesson, and in ways, it's a policy prescription, exploring the way that the term child abuse expanded to be so wide that children could be removed for ostensible offenses that are, as Raz describes, more closely related to poverty than actual maltreatment or abuse. And for some readers, this book will be uncomfortable. After all, it is politically popular to say that you stand for the protection of children in the strictest terms, that you will not tolerate children growing up with struggles or needs not always being met, and that you want a wider definition of child abuse to protect children. But Raz asks readers to examine the effect of this system and to call back to those reports from the late 1800s or early 1900s, warning against pulling families apart too quickly. She chronicles the ways that the American system evolved from a supportive one for families to a punitive system designed to criminalize struggling parents. And the question becomes, what happens next? Yes, in the foster care system, but in the child welfare system as a whole. Let me welcome our guest this hour. The author of the book, Abusive Policies, How the American Child Welfare System Lost Its Way, is Dr. Michal Raz, the Charles E. and Dale L. Phelps Professor in Public Health and Policy and Professor of History at the University of Rochester, Professor of Clinical Medicine in the URMC School of Medicine and Dentistry, and the author of this book, among other works. Thank you for being here, Dr. Raz.
Thank you so much for having me here today.
Also with us is Dr. Ashley Cross, founder and executive director of Hope 585. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
What is Hope 585?
Yeah, we are a Rochester-based nonprofit focused on building relationships with marginalized youth and their families so that they can hope, heal, and thrive. And our vision really is to see our city restored, and we believe that happens by moving families from systemic trauma to a place of power and belonging.
It's great to have you here. Thank you for being here, and welcome as well to Sherelle Harris, who is a young adult currently living in Hope 585's community-supported foster home and preparing to age out of foster care in June. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And a mother of six, Veronica Hay-Bowler, is with us. Welcome. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you for having me as well.
Dr. Raz, I was telling you before the program, this book really has pushed me to reevaluate my own sort of assumptions about what child abuse is and how we think about it and, frankly, how it is either policed, to use a very direct term, or considered. And I want to ask you why you decided to write this now, and then I want to walk through some of the history that you lay out.
Thank you very much. Well, this book is personal for me because I was living in Philadelphia doing my fellowship, and I had two small children and a dog. And my husband lived, he was stationed in Connecticut where he was on a submarine. And every evening, my kids were asleep, and I had to walk the dog. And I had to make the decision, you know, to leave the kids in their beds and walk the dog across the block. And I know that's a decision that some people would frown on, but it was a decision that was right for my family. So you can take a decision for the level of risk that you're willing to take. And I met and worked with women at a community action group who had their children removed for taking similar steps or making similar decisions. And it made me think, who gets to make decisions about what is right for their family? Who gets grace? Who is afforded this freedom to decide, you know, how to parent? And the answer is so often rooted deeply in race and class. So I wasn't worried that my children would be removed when I walked my fluffy little dog around the block. But my friend who I worked with, she had children removed when she had left them in the house and went quickly to the laundromat because she doesn't have a washing machine in her house. And how much of this is stratified by who has access to resources and who gets supports?
There's a lot of history that that you lay out, and particularly the 70s, 80s, 90s, a lot seemed to change in this country. And I want to ask you to start by telling the story of Parents Anonymous, if you don't mind. I think that's pretty instructive.
Absolutely. Thank you. Parents Anonymous was an action group that was formed by a woman who was worried that she might abuse her child. And she went by the pseudonym Jolly Kay. And she was very worried that she might kind of take steps that would be hurtful to her child. And she looked for support. And she realized there were not a lot of supports for parents. And she helped organize this group called Parents Anonymous that was modeled after Narcotics Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous, that parents would get together and talk about their struggles. And there was a lot of research about this group. And they found that parents who were mostly middle class, white, and educated, mostly women, they were primarily worried about verbally abusing their children. And that was the kind of abuse that was most likely to happen in their homes. And they got a lot of support from talking about to each other. But when you stop and think, that's actually not what we think about when we think about physical, when we think about child abuse. And it's really not what should be guiding policy. So a lot of policy that impacts children from a completely different socioeconomic status was designed for women who needed supports for parenting. And we know parenting is hard and people need support. So I'm not here to say something bad about Parents Anonymous, but to call questions about how this group gained so much influence and helped shape the idea that child abuse or maltreatment was an issue of bad choices that parents made, intrapsychic or psychological problems, and that they only had to take personal responsibility and be better parents, and completely ignored all the structural barriers that parents have to meet their parenting goals, the lack of resources they might have, and the ways in which society is set up that sets certain parents to fail. And once they fail, instead of lifting up to help them lift up and thrive, they say, okay, you failed at a parent, now you lose your children, or now it's time for punishment. So it's a story about how a group amassed so much power and helped shape a concept of child abuse that was so broad and all-encompassing, that verbal abuse and emotional neglect, which certainly are not good things, but they're completely different from physical and sexual abuse.
And Parents Anonymous is not an organization that I was familiar with before this book, but reading about the story of how this organization kind of grew in influence, popular media latched onto some of the themes that were really kind of pushed by Parents Anonymous, didn't it?
Absolutely. It was a very compelling story, right? You know, we made mistakes. We were bad parents, but now we repented. We've gotten to a group. We've taken responsibility, and we can change. It's kind of an all-American story of personal responsibility that's very compelling. But most cases that come to the attention of child welfare are not stories of personal responsibility and bad choices. It's about people making the best choices they can in a world of very limited choices. When you don't have childcare and you need to have a job and you don't have a job, and you come to a job interview and your childcare has bailed and you left that kid in the car. That's a terrible choice. But it was one choice of very few choices that a woman had, and she subsequently got arrested and lost custody of her children. This is a well-known case that happened a few years ago.
And let me just add, you write in the book, quote, Parents Anonymous actively discounted the ways in which poverty and social disadvantage contributed to child abuse, end quote. And if I'm remembering correctly, some of the members or leaders of the movement were absolutely explicit in saying child abuse is child abuse is child abuse. If you strike a child, if you sexually abuse a child, if you yell at a child, if a child does not have enough to eat, those are all the same and they should be treated with no difference, right?
That was absolutely one of the main tenets of the organization. And if you wanted to be part, you had to agree to that. All kinds of abuse are equal, and there's not one kind of abuse that's worse. And if you neglect the child, that might actually be worse than breaking their arm, because at least if you broke their arm, you're giving them attention. I do not agree with that, obviously. I think that is incredibly misguided. But that was the approach that Parents Anonymous took that helped popularize, broaden, and dilute the idea of child abuse so that almost anything could be seen as child abuse, opening the door for unlimited state power and intervention that would end up affecting primarily disadvantaged families.
This was popular with politicians, wasn't it?
It sure was.
And that shapes policies. Then you write in another section of the book, the child welfare services have been failing Black children in particular. You write, quote, racial disparities in the child welfare system were an open secret, end quote. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, from the 60s and 70s, it became very clear that when you bring or you invite intervention into families, these state interventions are primarily going to target poor families and families of color. And Black children were disproportionately represented at all stages. They were more likely to be reported, more likely to be investigated, more likely to be removed. Once they were removed, they were stayed longer. They were less likely to be reunified. They were less likely to be adopted. And all these disparities continue to this day. So it has a long history. And it's instructive about how we survey and punish certain families and afford decision-making freedom to other families. And that obviously stratifies by race and class.
One of my guests who you're hearing right now, Dr. Mikhail Raz, is the author of Abusive Policies, How the American Child Welfare System Lost Its Way. This book is intended to be read and really absorbed by whom, first and foremost? Who do you want to read this book?
Well, I hope that people who work with vulnerable children and who think about policies that impact vulnerable children will read this book. I know that it's been read by social workers, even by pediatricians, and by people who study political science. And I hope that it will have an impact as we shape policy. I don't always know that entire books are read, but I've also published kind of shorter op-eds that I know that have reached the desks of policymakers. And the reason I write about the history of this system, apart from caring deeply about history, being a history professor, is I think that the history can help inform us how to make a better future. So the policies we have are not inevitable. They're not even based on evidence. They were based on political expedience and what seemed to be popular and right at the time. And we know that they have a host of unintended consequences. And the more we learn about the evolution of these policies, this history can help inform us and free us of preconception that we must do things a certain way. And we can make different choices to help ensure that all children and all families can thrive, rather than reaching out to punish and investigate those that are struggling.
I want to ask you one more question about some of the history in your book before I turn to some of the other guests in the studio. Because again, I warned our guests we could be here all day based on this book. But there's a section in the book on the McMartin Daycare Child Sexual Abuse Panic that for me calls to mind some very recent, I'm going to use the term moral panic. I don't want to be callous to people who are genuinely concerned that there is an epidemic of predatory behavior toward children. Although there are some very weird conspiracy allegations about, you know, a cabal of political leaders who are running basement pizza shop sex rings, which, you know, don't exist. So I guess part of what I'm trying to say here is I don't want to discount concern about kids, and I know you don't either.
Absolutely.
I bring this up because I want you to tell the story of the daycare child sexual abuse panic that goes back in the 1980s, 83.
Mm-hmm.
That story and how it affected people, but then how context gets lost and then all of a sudden are we making policies based on reality versus a panic. Can you describe that?
Absolutely. So the 1980s saw this moment in which so many Americans were convinced that there was a satanic cult of abusers hiding in daycares that were ritually abusing children, doing all kind of unspeakable acts like drinking their blood and spiriting away in tunnels, killing animals, and a host of other horrific acts that probably never happened. And it reflected a growing concern about children being in the care of other people. You know, daycare is scary as a parent. It's understandable. And concerns about changes in society and about sexual mores. And it kind of all sparked from a certain case in California, the McMartin Daycare, where a woman who we later would find out was deeply disturbed, alleged that her child was sexually abused. And these allegations were taken by many well-intentioned professionals who developed a host of not evidence-based interventions to try to interview children and do physical examinations on the children to try to see whether they were abused. In the end, the thing that was most abusive were the interviews themselves and the physical exams that were very invasive and private. But this case, there are people who are still serving time in prison now based on allegations from this moment of panic. Now, I do want to say that, of course, some children regrettably are sexually abused in daycares. And that is terrible and that needs to be addressed. But that was not the case in the 80s. The 80s was a panic. That was not the case in the McMartin. They were not being abused. There was allegations of abuse and a moral panic, and people lost their jobs, lost their livelihood, lost their reputation, and some went to jail based on this panic. And it also led to a host of legislation and policy interventions designed to pay closer attention to abuse and to encourage people to come forward. Some of this is certainly good. You want to have policies that address sexual abuse and encourage victims to come forward. And some of this had a host of unintended consequences that we still live with today.
So everyone at this table has a different story to share and a different, you know, sort of approach to this conversation. What are the kinds of policies that are going to help Dr. Cross do her work and parents parent in a way that they feel supported? What are the policy changes you want to see?
Well, I think it's time to think about families as a unit and think about what families need to thrive rather than punishing parents for not meeting the needs of their children. So in a country that doesn't have, you know, universal daycare, guaranteed maternity leave, guaranteed health care, there's so many things that we can do that can help keep children safer. And we have evidence about this. For instance, one thing that helps prevent abuse is providing basic income or money for families so that they don't struggle. And during the COVID pandemic, when families were getting a child tax credit, there was a reduction in cases of abuse, which is probably related to the supports they received. So if we want to see families thriving, we need to give them the resources they need to thrive, including community supports, perhaps respite care so that mom can take a minute, areas where children can play safely so that they are not playing in unsafe areas, and making sure that communities are healthy and thriving would be the best way, in my mind, to help prevent harm to children.
Well, let me ask our other guests for a little bit of their own perspective. And Dr. Cross, when we kind of go through this history and we talk about some of the challenges that Dr. Roz poses for a system that, in her words, very bluntly, has lost its way. Yeah. You agree with a lot of her analysis and her prescription?
I do. I've heard child welfare workers say that they're not good parents, right? And so that the government should not be raising children. The government was not designed to be the parents to children, and that it would be much easier and much more effective if the community would wrap around parents and families who are struggling and give them the support that they need instead of tearing the family apart.
So what is it going to take to actually achieve some of the change that Dr. Roz advocates for? And are you optimistic that that is even achievable in the current sort of political and social climate?
You know, I am. I think it's going to take a lot of work. It's going to take a lot of work. And I know that there have been different initiatives that have tried to tackle system problems before and move the needle sometimes very little, which can sometimes be very concerning, and it, you know, will cause people to lose a little bit of courage and hope. But I am hopeful. I do believe that we need to see adaptive change. I don't think that this is going to require technical solutions, right? This is a big problem, and it's going to take policymakers, stakeholders, people with lived experiences, the education system, the healthcare system, getting in the same room to have hard conversations and come up with innovative solutions to narrow the front door to child protective services. I do think that our community has the strength and the resilience to help narrow the front door to child protective services by wrapping around struggling families. And we've seen that before, right? I think that if people understood that isolation, right, is really a lot of the reason that people live in poverty, right? We understand that poverty is very nuanced. It's a huge issue. But when we're talking about families who are at risk of being separated because of poverty, right, I think that that's something that we can get together and we can see things work. And we've seen small things work even at Hope 585, right? We have a system called the Care Portal. And it's a technology that CPS workers actually use when they go out to do an investigation. They don't want to remove a child because the child has dirty clothes and doesn't have the support that they need. So they can put the needs in the care portal, and that need shoots out to 500 community responders that we have trained and we have recruited, and those responders meet the need. Right. So something that simple, right? I'm not saying that the care portal is the end all be all, but that within itself is the type of approach that we need.
I want to listen to some of the remarks that were made earlier this month at a Rochester City School Board meeting. It was during an Equity and Student Achievement Committee meeting discussing chronic absenteeism and how the school district is addressing family crisis when they were looking at root causes of student absence. And if you haven't followed this issue, the Rochester City School District is not alone in this in post-pandemic America. But it has really, really serious truancy is not even the right word. It's chronic absenteeism. And some of these families where the students are growing up are literally homeless, and there's questions on even making contact. I want to listen to school board member Isaiah Santiago speaking with the deputy superintendent of the district, Ruth Turner, during a question and answer section on the attendance department's report on chronic absenteeism.
When we identify that a student is having some family crisis, like what are we doing to support them? Monroe County Department of Human Services, in fact, is such a huge system that a lot of families are kind of scared to tap into. And so I'm just wondering, like, what supports are we giving to families to help them through that process?
I'll jump right here. I wanted to underscore that for many of our community members, even myself, right? Thinking of Monroe County Department of Human Services is not always a welcomed resource. One of the things that we've been really fortunate to do with some of the support of some of our board members is to really strengthen that relationship. So what is important is there are preventative services that help families early on to avoid, right, those punitive interactions with Monroe County. And we have a dedicated individual that is assigned to work with our school district so that instead of getting into the foster care system or dealing with that punitive aspect, they're able to have resources through preventative services funds that allows them to address some of those issues. So some of it might be domestic violence. Some of it might be chronic illness, right? So that doesn't allow your single parent and you have a chronic illness that causes you to be sick for several weeks and you can't really take care of your children, get them to school. You don't have that kind of support. So those services are dedicated for our families so that they don't have to call a whole bunch of people and figure out what's going on. Again, those funds are limited, but it's been really instrumental to look at those high needs and get them those resources to avoid that punitive interaction with that system.
Let me ask Dr. Ross first, what do you hear in that clip?
I think this is certainly a positive approach to think about what are the supports that families need in order to prevent these kind of interventions. And I also appreciate the recognition that they say sometimes these child protective services are not a welcome intervention because they see them as a family police. And that's a term that many advocates use, not the child welfare system, the family policing system. And when you call the family police on families. So thinking about what are the barriers for families to attend school or to complete the course of therapy that the doctor has recommended, but the family is not able to do. And there's so many structural barriers that are not a sign of poor parenting or maltreatment, but a sign of really a society that has abandoned so many of its citizens and has not worked to lift them up. And I'm inspired to hear of all the work that's being done in Rochester by many dedicated professionals, as well as the work that I see that Dr. Ashley Cross is doing, that how families can be supported to lift them up and thrive.
Yeah. Dr. Cross, what do you hear there?
Yeah, no, it's hopeful to hear that, right? It's good when we're all speaking the same language and we are identifying the same root causes, right? And so hearing that for me does, you know, spark some hope, like, okay, we are making some progress. You know, I have questions, right? I hear there's limited resources, limited funding, right? So when I hear that, I'm like, okay, well, how much access? Because when we're talking about poverty, we're talking about a deep-seated poverty that a lot of our families are experiencing. And so even we have a cash assistance program that I know only just a small percentage of the burden that families live in under poverty experience. So I always, I hear that. It sounds very hopeful. I do believe that under the leadership of Dr. Turner and Isaiah, I think they're amazing. And they, my question always just is around the resources.
About the resources.
The resources, the access, the barriers to receiving that. Do families know what resources are out there? Because to me, Child Protective Services should not be seen as a resource for families.
Mm. Let me get one more email that I'm going to ask the guests on this side of the table, and then we're going to talk to their co-panelists as well. We're talking about primarily about the new book from Dr. Michael Raz, which is called Abusive Policies, How the American Child Welfare System Lost Its Way. And the email I'm about to read, I think, is probably emblematic of some of the criticism or some of the assumption that maybe even I, as a reader of this book, probably entered the book with. Tim writes to say, I'm sorry, but I don't think it's a good idea to downplay the effects of neglect and a life of poverty for children. That seems to me to be a form of abuse, and I have to wonder why people struggling with poverty have children if they don't have a means to support that child. How do we solve that problem? Dr. Raz, let me start with you. What would you say to Tim? That cannot be the first time you've heard a comment like that.
Well, I think that having child poverty is a shame for our country. And if somebody is the abuser, it is our country and our government. And that, yes, the fact that children are poor is hampering their potential, and we should do everything we can to make sure that children are not poor, that children are not hungry. The United States has the highest rate of poverty amongst children in all developed countries. And we should be deeply ashamed by that. And once we're done feeling that feeling, we should move forward and act to cut poverty and think about supports to families. I don't know if Tim meant to make that comment about poor parents should not have children, but people, of course, have a right to have whatever families they believe is right for them. That's a main tenet of reproductive justice. It's hard to kind of engage with that idea that people shouldn't be allowed to thrive just and to have reached their full potential and to be a parent just because they're poor. And I think the way to fix that is to make sure they're not poor rather than to ask, why are they having children?
Dr. Cross.
Yeah, and when I think of poverty, I think of isolation, right? Because I don't believe that most people living in poverty are only void of physical resources. They don't have relationships. They don't have those safety nets. And so I think that a lot of people, they come with almost this arrogance around poverty and how people got there, right? We're talking generational poverty here. We're talking about generations of poverty. When I sit with a CPS worker and I hear them say, I was this young man's grandmother's CPS worker, that's an issue. That's cyclical. And it's hard for people to climb themselves out of this level of poverty alone without resources. If my tire bursts today, I'm not losing my job next week. But a parent who's already living in poverty, that it's so unless you have ever probably lived in poverty and been alone, I'm sure it would be very hard to understand this. But I rely a lot on my safety net. And I know that my safety net is the reason that I'm able to even parent, because parenting is hard, let alone just life in general. Right. And so I think family is a blessing. I think family is a gift. And I think that family is something that everyone should have the benefit of experiencing.
And I just want to say to Tim as well, having read Dr. Raz's book, the book does not downplay the effects of neglect. That's the phrase that Tim used. I would not put it that way at all. The book does not downplay the effects of poverty for children. And in fact, the book is recognizing that poverty is a great challenge for families. The book is, I think, to me as a reader, first and foremost, saying we must differentiate before we break up families. The book would never call for limiting punitive results for actual physical sexual abuse, continuing forms of abuse in that realm. But the book is saying that poverty is the challenge that Dr. Cross just described, and there are well-meaning, really hard-working parents who are often single mothers, not always, really struggling and need support and used to get more support in terms, or at least used to get more of that, the approach to how do we help versus the last 50 years approach that says, how do we take that child out of that household?
Yeah. And even just thinking about climbing out of poverty, right? We've sat with mothers who have to choose between getting a job and keeping their food stamps, right? And so it's like we have a system that is designed for people to need the system because it doesn't incentivize people for getting a job. Right. For me, it's like, well, let them keep their food stamps for the next 6 months while they acclimate to a new job at a new instead of penalizing them for trying to get themselves out of poverty. And so it's
and it making almost it more likely that they won't. Right.
Correct. Correct. Yeah. So it almost feels like that's how it's set up to keep poor people poor because there are no incentives for getting a job. Right. It's almost you get penalized for trying.
Yeah. And I'm not speaking for Dr. Rush. She can speak for her own book. I'm just trying to summarize because we have limited time here. And Tim, I appreciate the email. I mean, I appreciate the question. I hope I summarized at least my take on it well enough, Dr. Ross.
And Evan, can I just say one more thing? Yeah. I'm a huge supporter of Bavona Child Advocacy Center, right? We understand that there are a small percentage of children in this nation who are horribly abused sexually and physically by parents, by people who their parents trusted. And we're not at all saying that we should ignore that. We should turn a blind eye. We're acknowledging the 80% of children who have an investigation each year that was due to neglect and probably could have been supported.
Veronica Hay Bowler is a mother of six, and I just wanted to ask you to tell a little bit of your own story and how you're doing and maybe what life has been like for you as a parent.
Well, I was born into foster care. My mother, foster mother, was a nun, so I had a lot of resources growing up. When I was seven, I was adopted by a family here in Rochester. At the age of 12, I ran away from that home. I did not feel like I had a set route of people that was there that I could go and talk to or that I even have now as a mom of six. I don't have my mom. I don't have somebody I can go drop my kids off to. I have to rely on my older kids to help me with my younger kids. That's my system.
How old are your oldest?
My oldest is 17 and 15. Mm-hmm. So those two are my biggest helpers. If I need something done, they do it. And sometimes it does. Somebody might have to stay home from school. Somebody might not be able to go on that field trip. Somebody might not be able to get the prom dress they wanted. But I'm going to figure it out as a mom because there is no other option. There's no other person that's going to come down and be my fairy godmom. Now, recently, I was homeless for the last 8 months of last year. And that's where I had no choice in January but to call CPS on myself. Because no, they would not put me in a shelter. I was paying for my own hotel rooms. I could not get any resources whatsoever because my six-year-old is disabled, so she gets SSI. So DSS deems that as being self-sufficient. So I could pay my own rent, but if I don't have a place where it's a set, you know, price every month and I'm asking I need this type of help, why isn't there more of a program or more of a actual group of people or team that is set there to come and say, hey, this is where we can put you. This is how we can do this. Because we were left out there for at least 4 to 5 months with nothing. And we had to figure it out. I had to figure it out.
Where did you and your kids go?
We started off at the Red Roof Inn. After that, they placed us at the Best Western on Buell Road for probably about a week. Then I was working at the airport. So they were saying as soon as I got my paycheck, use all that money and immediately pay for a room. But that would only pay for 2 days because the weekend goes up. So then we would literally be out there on Sunday. Every Sunday, it was ritual. We knew every Sunday we would have to unpack our room, pack it all up, take it downstairs, wait in the parking lot, and find some. I would either have to go do plasma. I might even have to go and find a research study. I would have to even have to go and beg somebody, hey, please, I need, or just take my kids. You know, like, just take my kids because it's not I'm failing. How can I get back into working if there is no daycare, but you're telling me you won't pay for daycare? But I'm not asking for anything but help with my medical insurance for my disabled child and for food stamps. I pay my own rent, been doing it for 10 years. I'm a security guard. I'm a CNA. But I lost all these certificates when the pandemic hit because they were giving us all this help. Then they just took it all away, and now we just stuck here, and now I'm trying to get back working. And it's just like you get interview after interview, but if you haven't been working for this long time, some jobs are just like, hey, you got to go out there and get some more experience. And then I'm like, I'm 36 years old. Like, I have enough experience. I've been working since I was 12. Like, I know what it takes to raise these kids. And even me having, when I had just four kids, it wasn't that I grew up in foster care and I want to be in poverty and why should I stop having kids? I have kids because Who else is going to love me and take care of me when I get old? Where's my system going to come from? Where is my support? I had to make it, so I made it. I made my own family. I made my own bloodline, so I'll pass my legacy of kindness and love on to them. Hopefully. Hopefully.
I see the tears welling in your eyes, and I just want, grab one of those. I'm grateful that you're willing to share your story, and I don't want to push too hard here.
Oh,
I know
no.
This is not
you
easy.
You can never.
Okay. I mean, I understand you've dealt with far worse than any of you, but I want to respect your story. Can you describe for listeners what in those 8 months, what's the hardest night or few nights like with your kids?
The hardest night I could say is it wouldn't be the nights, it would be the days where we might wake up in the room that was paid for the night before. We wake up and they know at a certain time because they're seeing the tears in my eyes and I'm like, I gotta figure this out. I gotta go out here and do it because who else is going to love and care for my kids? Luckily, some of those people inside of those hotels were so friendly and so understanding that they would let us sleep in their car.
Oh, man.
You know, they would say, hey, let the kids come in and play with my kids in the room, you know, and at 30, 45 minutes, you could knock on the window and you could see them sleeping on the floor. So, you know, they're safe because we are strangers. But at some point in time, you have no choice but to believe in a stranger, because if you're raised in foster care and like me, both of my biological parents are gone, I have nobody else. So it's me. And it's people that I deemed my family along the way, but then they still went on to have their own lives. Now I'm left, it's just me and my kids. We wake up and it's just us. So we figure it out. Like the other day, it's a pantry named St. Andrew's on Portland. Miss Carol that works there, she's a blessing. She knows sometimes I have to come there twice a month, and that means the next month I won't be able to come, but she will let me do it, and she understands. Sometimes she has blankets, pillows. I just moved into this house. I don't have furniture like that. DSS brought some things, a bed frames, but then what is the other essentials my child might need? Because that's not the only thing that helps support them. They go to school. They get teased. I can't buy them Jordans. I can't go out here and buy purses, match your outfits. I can't get your hair, nails done. Boys, I can't get haircuts like that. I got to figure this out myself. So I'm a woman of multitude of skills because I have to be the barber, the dad, the uncle, the granddad, the grandma, the auntie, the cousin, the pastor, I have to be everything all wrapped into one. I said one day I'll be able to just go out here and just be myself and figure myself out. But now it's all about my kids, all about them.
You can tell how much you love your kids.
Yeah, they my rocks. I tell them they my marbles. I can't never lose my marbles.
Are you worried about losing them?
I worry about not losing them, but I just worry that I'm not doing enough, that I'm not pushing myself to go out here and be more, to do more. I'm an introvert. I don't have friends. I don't talk to nobody. It's just my children. I don't look at it like I'm a loner or that this is somewhere I want to be, but this is how I've been since I was a kid. This is my wall to stop hurt from coming in, but not for me, but for my kids. Because if I'm your friend and you come in and love me and my kids for 6 months, and then all of a sudden we get in one argument and you disappear, my kids are more traumatized than I am. Now I have to figure this out. If you come in and I'm dating you and we're talking for 2-3 years and you just up and leave to go be with another family or just because it just wasn't working out, that hurts my kids too. So I've learned to just be me by myself. I have a significant other. He is amazing. I've been with him for 5 years, and June 23rd we'll be together 6 years. My youngest two are by him. We just got back around. I can't say how much help he is, but we're still can't be in the same household because that's now DSS will take anything that he has done wrong in his life and it's used against him. He can't be on my case. And right now, Section 8 just opened their waiting list. I'm waiting to get out of here to go apply for this. I'm hoping I get on the waiting list. But it's like, I can't put him there. He can't be in my household. He's like an acquaintance, but my kids know nothing but us. And if he can't be there, it's just me. And I go, the only other person I can ask is God. And you know, his answers are in his own time. You got to let it happen, you know? He's always carrying us. It's always footprints in the sand.
How are you doing now? You described the last, you know, an 8-month stretch last year of homelessness. How are you now?
Oh, I am ecstatic. I can't wait for summertime. Oh, I love cooking. So I'm going to be trying to go out here and get me some type of food permit for a little food cart and start a little stand in the front. Maybe even have my little Queen Miley and King Marcus do a little lemonade stand or sell a little bread, something. But it's always a way out of it. It's always a way. Is if there is a will, and it's always a will inside of me, there's a way. So now I feel like this summertime, I'm going to just go outside my comfort zone. I'm going to go out here and do things I didn't do, meet people, say hi when I didn't want to say hi because I was afraid that I might get hurt, but more so I'm afraid my kids might get hurt. I don't want my kids loving too much, you know?
I understand. I mean, look, I'm one of the more advantaged people who's ever lived. I can't put myself in your shoes, but I can tell you I can relate to the fact that you're more scared for your kids than you are for yourself.
Yeah.
And I can understand the feeling that you're going to put yourself out there, but I also know that you sound like you're someone who wants to work and just wants stability. I mean, what is change in a good way look for you? Is it work? Is it housing stability? You know,
change in a good way would be work stability, because now I found my own housing stability. Now I have my own house, 4-bedroom, whole house, beautiful. Got a large backyard. The people that lived there left the playground in the back, so gave my kids something to do once I cleaned it off. Now I just want to be able to go to work, but then it's like if I go to work and I show it to DSS, just give them that employer statement, my food stamp level is going to go down. And I'm like, hey, I need that, because in that time I'm getting those checks in that first 3 to 6 months, I could be using those food stamps to stack, get a deep freezer, make sure that's full. That helps to be able to have resources of your own to lean back on. I don't want to just lean it on the community or, you know, just Rochester as a county. Hey, I need this help. No, I'm thinking of trying. I'm just now learning that with EBT, you can go out here and buy seeds to plant your own garden, to do your own thing. I love homesteading. Do this on your own, because at some point we're all going to have to go back to that old professional way and grow our own food if you actually want to be healthy, you know? So I'm trying to teach my kids planting, gardening. Let's go out here. I said, I don't trust yet to do the hunting or the fishing because, you know, water and all that. But at some point I'll get there, you know? I'll get there and I'll go catch my own food. If it has to take that in order for my children and us to be stable, and if I can't always have the funds by means of working, I will figure it out.
Veronica, I just met you today, but your kids are lucky to have a mother who loves them the way you do.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
And there's no doubt about that. I also think that this is partially why Dr. Michal Raz wrote this book.
Absolutely. It's an honor to be in your presence.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, I'm looking over at Ashley. I'm like, oh my, we're all going to be crying.
Listen, I said it. I'm sorry, but it's just, it's so much out here where people don't think of. It's not only your homestead of life, like being in foster care is going to school. Going to school, sometimes you get bullied because sometimes those stipends don't always buy you what you want. You know, it's just hard all around. The support doesn't just come from a mother and a father. It comes from the pastor. It comes from your neighbor. It comes from the bus driver. It comes from everybody. Spread that kindness and love, because you could be brightening a kid's day, more likely for them to go and say, hey, I'm being abused, something is happening to me, than if you are, oh, go, I don't want to talk to you. No, welcome there. Hey, child, hey, I see any kid on the street, just speak to them. Say, hey, you making them more comfortable to be in this world, because it's already hard as it is.
Boy. That's Veronica Hay Bowler. I want to turn to Sherelle Harris, who I'll give you some space to kind of tell your story and how you're doing these days.
Well, these days I'm doing well. I'm 20 years old. Next month I age out of foster care. I've been in foster care since I was 2 years old. My mother got her parental rights taken from me because an addict found me at a house that wasn't sustainable and called the police, and that's how I got into care. I've been in over 70 residential placements, group homes, foster homes, in and outside of Rochester. now I am in the Hope 585 house with my foster parent, Tiffany. And I always say to Tiff that I've never stumbled across somebody that genuinely cares about kids besides one other foster parent that I know. I never thought that when I was younger, I never thought that foster parents were supposed to care. That's how often it didn't happen. And that doesn't always mean abuse. That doesn't always mean any type of abuse sexually, mentally. It's just neglect. They're doing it for the check. They're required to give you a bed. They're required for you to get 3 meals a day. They're required, if you're in school, for you to go to school, but that's all you're getting. A lot of kids in foster care that I ran across, they don't have a parent. They don't have anybody to give them the nourishment, the love that they need right now because they just got ripped from a home, you know?
How has it been with Hope 585?
I never thought that there was a way to have too much support until I've been in Hope 585. Down to my foster parent, down to the staff at Hope 585 who just, they want you to succeed no matter what. You tell them you want to be an astronaut, they're going to find some programs for you to be an astronaut. I think when it comes down to foster kids, a lot, especially kids that are aging out of care, they don't know how to live on their own, because in a way, the system kind of enables you. You have support when it comes financially. You have somewhere to sleep. You have food to eat. These things aren't being taught because these foster parents don't feel like teaching them.
Ashley Cross, you want to add to some of what you're hearing from the story? What do you think when you hear this story?
Yeah, so, you know, Sherelle's story and her experience is the reason that I even got into this work. My first job out of college was at a shelter, and I was working with young people who were preparing to age out of the foster care system. And I remember there were times that we were putting kids on their 18th birthday in taxis, right, to go to Salvation Army because they didn't have anywhere to go. And so that's really why I got into this work, because I started to see that the foster care system does not, they don't raise children. They don't raise children well. They might keep them sometimes physically safe, but they're not teaching them what they need to be productive citizens. And then we see that there's this pipeline, right? We talk about the school to prison pipeline, but we don't talk about the foster care to prison pipeline or the foster care to homelessness pipeline. And so hearing what Shay is saying, you know, Hope 585, I think it's funny when she's like, well, I've never been somewhere I felt like I could have too much support. That's really the goal. Like, I want for kids, like, okay, you guys can back up a little bit. I got it, right? But we realize that there has been such a deficit in their lives of support that we want for them to feel overly supported so that when they age out of foster care, like Sherelle knows, she can age out. That means nothing to us. Like, you know, she ages out, and if in 6 months after aging out she needs some advice, she's going to have a Rolodex of people that she can choose from to call to say, hey, can we just talk this through? Like, I just need some support. And so it's nice to hear that she feels overly supported, because that's the goal, is to feel overly supported, but also feel like there's a place that can teach you what you need to know.
In most foster homes, going back to what you said, aging out doesn't mean anything. You're gone.
In most foster homes,
you're gone.
You age
at
out
21,
and you're gone.
That day of your birthday, you have to go. Especially,
that's incredible.
And a lot of these kids, I was always so scared when I was like eight. When I turned 18, I was always so scared that I was going to be another foster kid statistic. I was terrified I was going to end up homeless, too young to be pregnant, in prison. I always knew that I needed some support, but I never knew how to articulate myself to get it. And I didn't know where to go to get it until I met one specific foster parent. I met her when I was 18. So for 16 years, there wasn't one person for me. When I was 18, she taught me so many things, so many different ways how to view life in get ahead of this and get ahead of that. And even now that I'm not with her, I still call her my mother. And I also, and now that I'm in the Hope 585 home, Tiffany's been, that's my foster parent. Tiffany's been the most helpful person. The only thing she wants is to see kids thrive and to see kids leave the system with something. Leave the system if it's knowledge, if it's financially stable, a career. The hope for the house is to get these kids ready for adulthood, to teach these kids what they haven't been taught.
Are you ready?
I'm ready. It's hard to find apartments, houses right now. It's just extremely hard. I saved up a lot of money. I've been working for a long time. I saved up a lot of money to be able to get the things I kind of want. But right now I'm in the dilemma of finding an apartment, looking for one that can take my income, because a lot of these houses and apartments, yeah, they tough. Need three times the rent a month, or credit score has to be 850, and that's really hard.
Well, I know
to
you
deal
have
with.
A lot of support, and we're about to lose the hour. I just want to ask Dr. Rouse in our last 25-30 seconds, these stories of the foster care system, and it bears its own conversation. Is that partially why you want to make sure that we're not pulling kids out of families so quickly?
Absolutely. What I hear is so much of a story of loss of your community, loss of your kin, loss of your lineage, loss of your identity. And of course, there are foster parents who are wonderful and do the most they can. But when people call CPS and CPS comes and quickly removes a child, Then there is so much loss that comes to that, and there's so much we can do instead to be restorative and uplift and support. And if there's a problem with addiction, services with the child or supports with the child, so that families, that people don't lose so much in the system and don't have to rebuild. Thank you so much.
The book is called Abusive Policies, How the American Child Welfare System Lost Its Way. Where do you want people to find it?
On the website of the publisher, right, the University of North Carolina Press, or on Amazon.
Dr. Michelle Raz, thank you for being with us. Dr. Ashley Cross, Executive Director and Founder of Hope 585, thank you.
Thank you.
And I want to thank Sherelle and Veronica. Much love and best of luck to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you as well.
Admire you both. From everyone at Connections, thanks for listening. And we're back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.